This is The State of Things. I'm Gail Harris. Southern humorist Roy Blunt Jr. once observed that North is a direction, but the South is a place. Of all the people in all the regions that make up the United States, Southerners have long believed that we had a corner on a sense of place, surrounded as we are by stately oak trees dripping Spanish moss, winding roads and tobacco barns, endless acres of corn and cotton. Things move more slowly in the South. We have been, more than most, suspended in time. Some might say stuck in the past, even as the present changes every time we look around. Dairy pastures turn into four-lane highways, the local hamburger stand offers fajitas, ads for new subdivisions housing thousands of people from elsewhere fill page after page in the Sunday newspapers. And yet, what we now call globalization is actually nothing new. In the Charleston of the 1700s, 50 languages were spoken. And now what? As the South looks ever more outward in the 21st century, what does that mean for Southern identity, for pride of place, for how we look at ourselves and the world? Today, on The State of Things, we are wrestling with that elusive concept of Southern identity. And we want to hear from you. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. And we ask, what does it mean to be from the South? And has that changed over your lifetime? Did the South ever have a separate identity? Or was it mostly the product of movies or Depression-era photographs of the rural poor? Well, joining me in the studio is James Peacock, a professor of anthropology and comparative literature at UNC Chapel Hill. He is the author of The American South and a Global World and is also chairing a conference today on globalization and the American South at the Friday Center. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And let's start by explaining what you mean by globalization and where do you draw the borders around the South?
Very good. Potomac to the Rio Grande, you could simply say, for the American South. And globalization, of course, has no borders. That's the point. Everyone and everything connected to everyone and everything.
Truly, we are all in this together, more so than we ever were in the past. But if the questions aren't new, why is it still important and interesting for us to be talking about this?
Let me suggest Turning Point and Copernican Revolution to address that question. Very briefly, if you think of the last 400 or 500 years of the South, you can think of 1600, 1700, when there was no South as a region. There was simply a global network stretching from Europe through the Caribbean over to Africa, and into the eastern South, Charleston, that's the 50 languages you mentioned, Savannah and other places. And then when the new nation of the USA was created, the South became a region and turned inward around 1830 and inland and seceded, and the Civil War and Reconstruction cemented a sense of opposition. And then today, let's say starting around the 90s with the great influx of new immigrants, Hispanic, Asian, and others, we're turning outward again. So that's the significance, is that an inward turning region is seemingly now turning outward with lots of ambivalence, of course, job loss and fear of terrorism, but still, I think, on a road to global.
Well, congratulations on being to condense that much history into that little time. How would you describe the sense of place that many Southerners feel, given all of that? Is it mostly a romantic imagining, or is it real?
In a nutshell, both. and changing. May I suggest that the romantic sense of place, which is based more on ancestry, where you came from, where you stayed, who died there, history, is there, to be sure, still, and has, as Roy Blunt said, characterized the South as a sense of place. But today, several things are undermining that. Two of them actually seem to be at odds with each other, but I think they're both having the same effect. Development and ecology. Developers are tearing down and building ecologists trying to preserve, but they are changing the perception of place from a memory-based to more of a scientific-based environment. Environment is a scientific way of thinking about place. So I think both those are impacting.
Well, how much of that sense of place was influenced as well by the fact that people tended to stay in one place for generations? So those roots went very deep. It wasn't so much constant change as it was perhaps in other regions. Is that about it?
That is true. That's certainly a big part of it. Actually, in the conclusion to our book, American South in a Global World, we give a list of the states where people stayed longest and left less often. And southern states 30 or 40 years ago were at the top of that list. Today they're not. Pennsylvania, for example, is.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that is interesting because, we do tend to have a different sense of that. Well, let's get to what's happening now. You were referring to all of these other people discovering the South and some of the tensions that result from that. And also some of the people who were here all along are not so sure what they feel about that, whether it's such a good thing to have this big influx of people. What is that doing to Southern identity?
Let me tell a joke which is going around Chatham County among Hispanics. Jesse Helms and Jesse Jackson argue, is God black or is he white? And they both die and go to heaven, and God greets them, Buenos dias, amigos. So what has been thought of perhaps as more of a dualism, black and white, becomes more pluralistic. And as you suggest, that's not necessarily greeted with joy by everyone. Sometimes there are reactions to it. Fundamentalism, for example, may be one such.
Well, and some of the other reactions, do you see those as drawn along cultural lines of, I don't get who these people are? Or is it a more practical day-to-day, I get out of my driveway and now there's 9 million people on the roads and I can't get to where I'm going as quickly as I once could?
All of the above, and of course, outsourcing, loss of jobs, which is a terrible thing for many people, is part of that. And then the political expression, the red states, blue states, conservative, progressive, is another part of it.
And so when you look at globalization, do you see it as a good thing or a bad thing or simply something that we have to do our best to grapple with and make peace with?
I see it as a tsunami, which means you can't undo it. It's a huge tidal wave. It feeds on itself, and it has bad and good features. On balance, I would say good.
Tsunami sounds pretty threatening,
though.
I know,
though. Tsunami sounds terrible, but if you can think of a good tsunami.
Do you find that people who move to the South now assimilate the same way that they did in the 1800s and perhaps the early to mid-1900s? They become part of where they are, or do they still feel that while they may be living in the South now, that they really are more identified or identify themselves with where they came from?
That's a terrific and hard question. The South has been known for assimilation of a sort. The Jewish joke, Shalom, y'all, for example. But the new wave of immigrants, it remains to be seen how much assimilation. It is quite remarkable, for example, if you meet people from India or China or Mexico who are second generation and have strong Southern accents. It leads you to think, yes, assimilation. On the other hand, if you look at neighborhood segregation, and that varies from, say, working class Hispanics or, say, Cary, North Carolina, where the new professionals from all around the world may live separately from. So there's both.
Well, speaking of that, we've got Frank on the line from Wake Forest who wants
right.
to join the conversation. Hello, Frank, and welcome.
Thank you. I wonder if the guests would care to remark on the erosion in the distinctive dialects or accents that exist all across the South as time progresses and as the generations pass. As a child, I remember very distinctly that my grandparents had a very different sound than I did, and I have a very different sound than my own children do, and yet the fact is my family's been from North Carolina for 300 years. One used to be able to hear instantly whether one of your fellow citizens was from the east, the middle, or the western portion of the state, or various other parts of the South. And yet, after 16 years in the Midwest, I returned to discover that most people younger than me seem to appear to have grown up inside a television set instead of inside a family with a distinctive inflection in their voice.
Frank, thank you so much for the call.
Frank, I have the same experience with my daughters and their friends. You're right about the variation in accents and also about some loss of that variation. If you go to Ocracoke, for example, or Harkness Island, which did for a long time and still does have a kind of 18th century British accent, that is diminishing because of tourism and other things. And I think you're also right about living inside the television set. When I hear my daughter's friends and they, sometimes I think that I live in outside the television set because they all talk like those sort of valley girls.
Oh dear, I hope not. Well, this is The State of Things, and we're talking this hour about Southern identity, defining what Southern identity is and also how it's affected by the spread of global culture. We've been speaking with Jim Peacock, professor of anthropology. And Jim, I know you need to get back to the Globalization of the American South Conference, so thanks again for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And we're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. What does it mean to be from the South? How long do you have to live here to feel Southern? Coming up, more perspectives and more of your calls. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Gail Harris, and we're talking this hour about Southern identity, what makes life in the South different from life in other places, and how the mixing of global and local culture may be changing our idea of what it means to be Southern. We're joined by two of the participants at today's Navigating the Globalization of the American South conference at UNC Chapel Hill. Tom Rankin is director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. He grew up in Kentucky, and he has spent much of his life and career contemplating the nature of Southern identity. Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Riche Richardson. Riche grew up in Montgomery, Alabama, and attended graduate school at Duke. She is now a professor of English and African American literature at the University of California, Davis. Riche, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We're also taking your calls this hour at 1-877-962-9862. And perhaps in the spirit of full disclosure, I should tell you that I grew up in Atlanta and worked and lived in North Carolina for about 5 years before I went up north a long time ago. But it's such a pleasure for me to be back on home soil. So this is a really interesting conversation to be part of as well. Tom Rankin, let me pose a similar question to you that Jim and I were talking about a minute ago, and that is, why is this interesting? Why do we even talk at great length about Southern identity?
Well, I think one reason is Southerners are obsessed, as you just did. You identified where we're from, not where we live now. And, you know, when you meet a Southerner and you ask where they're from, they're going to tell you where they were born, not that they're from Duke or from wherever they're living. But I think the other reason that this is important to talk about is that Southern identity evolves. And we get, you mentioned earlier the Walker Evans photograph or the notion of sort of mythic South. And it's important to keep talking about this in more complex terms to measure just what it is we mean when we say the South, just how the South is changing. The South's always been changing, and we at our peril think there was a day when it wasn't. There were certainly times when it was more turned inward, and as Jim said, it's focused much more outward now. But there's a kind of continuum of connection with an outside world, with other cultures that this is the day we're in now is a part of. And I think to see it in that way allows us to live in a more contemporary frame and to understand each other now instead of have to go back and reconcile misunderstandings later.
And Riche, you've also devoted your career to studying the South and African-American identity. Why did you make that choice?
I think I made the choice to understand my own life and experiences in a better way. I was initially concerned about the ways in which Southerners are so frequently stereotyped in the African-American context, and so my interest evolved, I think, from research questions that I began to formulate as early as my college days, but that morphed into a more formal enterprise in terms of what I do in my own work.
And so do you think we are moving beyond those stereotypes now?
To a certain degree, we are. I think that there's still a lot that needs to be done, though, for people to understand that Southern identity is organically with us as far as the African-American experience goes. It's not something that we can reduce to our ancestors or to traditions and all the kinds of ways in which people want to displace the notion of what it means to be Southern to the past. We also have to remember it as a part of our viable present.
Well, and as we remember it, Tom, is it something that we really cling to, that Southerners in general cling to those notions, to the idea that identity is important?
I think there is. There's both a genuine sort of positive clinging of understanding where we came from and staying connected, and then there's that mythic, more nostalgic clinging to an identity that may never have existed except in our invented imagination. I think that Southerners, I need to say, and I guess everybody knows, that they're all people in all corners of this country and the world who cling to their place and their street corner and their identity of where they're from. But there has been an abiding interest among Southerners to claim this place, and it's our peculiar history in part. It's our, it's this stereotyping which is happened for a long, long time. It's this sense of being downtrodden by. It's a sometimes comes from a place of some defeat,
or defensiveness,
or overcompensation, and all of that feeds into to that sense of place and Southernness and. At the same time, it's so easy to oversimplify this. I had a friend who, you know, when he was hearing about sense of place, said it sounded like people that had sense of place sounded like people who didn't have sense to leave for a better life. And so you can get into a very, very nostalgic, romantic notion of and begin to sound as if nobody else that lives anywhere understands where they live or is tied to their place.
Well, let's see what some of our listeners have to say about this. Raymond's on the line from Sanford. Hi, Raymond.
Hi. Good
Welcome.
Afternoon. Good afternoon, everybody. It's funny when you guys are speaking about this because it somewhat goes back to my family history. I'm an African American who kind of grew up in two different places. As a little boy, my parents lived in Charleston, South Carolina, and during the 60s when the Civil Rights Movement was tending to be at its height, my parents' lives were threatened. And we had to move away to Seattle to where some friends lived. And most of my, I guess, formative years and adult years I spent in Seattle, Washington. And when my parents decided to move back, and I moved back because as they got older, I wanted to keep an eye on them, my friends and colleagues in Washington, now keep in mind, now these are educated individuals, were fearful of us moving back to South Carolina, and we're talking about late 70s, early 80s, thinking that as African Americans, we were going to be lynched, the Klan was going to walk down the middle of the street, and again, this we're talking about late 70s and 80s, and you think about it because you're saying to yourself, are the impressions of the South that unusual throughout the country? Are the impressions of the South, you know, the persons who walk around with Daisy Dukes on, you know, the Bumstead type people. Mm-hmm. I forgot the cartoon, but it's almost like the rednecky backward type mm-hmm. individuals, and it's also the belief as an African American in various other places in the country, especially in the, I guess you would say in the West, at least where I grew up, that the South is still the South. When you think of the South, you think of the Klan, you think of things like that, and it's just unusual. So when we did move back here, we knew that wasn't the case, but there was still a guard up saying, okay, we're waiting for the first cross to be burned, we're waiting for this, and essentially it never happened. But it's just unusual that there was always that feeling in the back of your mind that something like that actually would happen in the South, even though you knew that was never going to happen.
Raymond, thank you so much for the call. That sounds like a good question to put to Riche. And do you encounter that same sort of thing in California in terms of attitudes that you see on the campus there?
I think I tend to see more of the romance if I'm circulating on campus or in Sacramento, even where I live. There's this sense that somehow being Southern makes one different, more genteel from the rest. I think that Raymond speaks well to the ambivalences that have existed about Southern identification in the African-American context, because first and foremost, the South has been a scene of trauma and dispossession for many African-Americans, and so the relationship to the region has been quite conflicted. And then it's also a site of liberation. It's been the major scene of liberation with the historical civil rights movement. We can think about the beginning trend in the 1970s toward African-American return migration to the South, which has peaked in the contemporary era and bespeaks more opportunities that many African-Americans now associate with the South. But then, on the other hand, we have the tragedy of the death of James Byrd in Jasper, Texas, so that the perception of the South is one of suspicion to a certain extent in the African-American context.
Well, certainly one of the other perceptions, I think, of Southerners is that we all have at least one or two really eccentric relatives. That one probably is more true than others. I want to bring Bonnie from Pittsburgh into the conversation now. Hello, Bonnie.
Hey.
Welcome to the conversation. What did you want to add?
Thank you for taking my call. I was just listening to Renee, and African-Americans are not the only ones that are considered different. As Southerners, I was just going to, my only comment was that as we become more homogenized, I really miss the way we used to talk. Like, I say to my husband things like, well, I'm fixing to go to the store, but that's not anything I would say in public to anybody because it sounds so ignorant. And I'll say something like, I swan, or I'll say, well, that's all right then. And if I really get upset, I'll say, well, I'll look at my husband, I'll say, well, jump down, turn around. And just, you know, stuff like that. And you just do not hear, I mean, I picked all of that up from, you know, from my parents, and you just do not hear stuff like that anymore. I mean, we're losing it. And, I mean, not that that's so special, you know, those particular things.
Well, but Bonnie, you certainly could say, thank you, that it's one of the things that makes us interesting. My personal favorite, I'm starting to fix to commence to begin to get ready to do something.
That's right.
So, but Tom, we were talking earlier about how things are changing and, you know, this perception that things change more slowly in the South. Is that still true? Because it certainly seems as if that the pace of change has accelerated tremendously here.
Yeah, I don't know that is true at all. I think, you know, the South is changing fast, and some of the change, some of the tensions and change, I begin to think are as much a result of the rural-urban change, and so we may be seeing a lot more commonality in rural areas with the South with other rural areas of this country. The change that where people are really feeling dramatic change, I think, is people who say have farmed for three or four generations and that way of life is ending, or small communities that are small towns that are drying up. And those people, for very good reason, feel that the world is dramatically changing.
Although that's happening across the country,
and
isn't
it's happening, and that's my, you know, that's part of my point, is that I think there's a common experience that's happening. That doesn't mean that, I mean, the Southerners have other attributes to their life that are unique, but that's happening across the country, and that sense of what was it, Bonnie, that just called in, of you know, expressions changing and dialect changing is happening in other places as well. At the same time, I'll say that the death of regional dialect and regional culture has been highly exaggerated for a long time, and that there is a things that are carrying on or morphing into new kinds of regional expressions. And as we're changing much faster, there's things that that are still very distinct, and we all know them when we drive around.
Matthew from Burlington wants to get on the conversation as well. Hello, Matthew. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk a little bit about my own experience in moving here to the South, which happened about a year ago. And I moved
from
here,
where?
By way of Virginia. I came from Wisconsin originally, and went to school around the D.C. area. And then after graduating, I came to Burlington with my girlfriend that I picked up in.
I'm sorry. We seem to have lost him. It is a common experience, though. I wonder how many people who come here, you know, how long do you have to be here before you're a Southerner? Where do you draw those lines? Is there such a thing, Riché? Do you see it in your studies as to how people identify themselves, and particularly when they come from other areas?
I think there is a sense to a certain extent that one has to pay one's dues. I would say that location definitely means a lot. And so being in a place kind of commits one to that place in a sense. And then I think that there are oftentimes resistances that so-called outsiders can feel when they encounter the South, so that they can easily sense that even if they are in the region, they are not of it, because somehow they have not been absorbed into the intricate circles in the community that really matter. I've seen this in Montgomery, where I'm from, at least from a distance. Like, whenever I go, lots of people relocate to the area primarily because of the military or other job opportunities, but feel alienated in a sense, or at least in some cases, from the fabric of community life. So the questions, the issues, I think, are not easy.
I want to find out what Tandy from Raleigh would like to add to the conversation. Hi, Tandy. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I want to say good afternoon, y'all. This is a great, great topic, a topic near and dear to my heart. I live in Asheville now. I happen to be in Raleigh for the day, and my people came to the States and settled in Steel Creek, North Carolina, which doesn't really exist anymore. It's been subsumed by the airport. Everybody's buried there. Everybody goes there to get buried. I just came here for a family funeral that was held yesterday in Reynolds, Georgia, another tiny little community. I wanted to talk about the powerful yearning I have to connect with my Southern identity, my sense of my people and my culture, and it's sort of trans-ethnic, but my people and my culture, the people who created this culture, and the pain I have felt because I don't have a Southern accent. I spent 3 formative years of my childhood in Northern California and didn't get one, and so I've always felt like I understood myself to be part of a community that other people, insiders as well as outsiders, did not understand me to be part of. And I noticed over time I've developed a bunch of strange behaviors to try to be part of that group, like eating barbecue.
That is not a strange behavior.
It's natural. It's very natural.
I'm addicted to it myself. That's my one complaint about California, actually.
We're eating it right now.
Are you really?
Well, not yet, but we will be shortly. Tandy, thank you so much for the call. And that, you know, that is a yearning that I think many people feel. Now, maybe you feel it just as much everywhere else in the country as you do here, but I do get that sense.
To be connected to the region, to feel...
Absolutely.
Like, you know, I want to say when in this context that being from Kentucky, which my family has no question whether Kentucky's a southern state or not, but Kentucky is a questionable southern state in some contexts. And I lived in Mississippi for a long time, and in Oxford, Mississippi, one night one of my neighbors decided that I was from a border state, which was, in his mind, a real allegation of, you know, questionable merit of just where you're from. And
did you take offense?
Well, we talked about it for a while, and I got over it. But I think that the it's important to there are a lot of Souths, and that it, you know, we can talk about it as one big place. But the world of Montgomery is so different from the world of Charleston, the world of the Upland South. Even, you know, when I moved from Mississippi to here, many people in Mississippi joked, you know, I hope you enjoy it up north. That North Carolina compared to the Deep South is a very, very different place. And And we need to kind of keep that in mind as we talk about these badges of identity and place and accent and so on.
What is your challenge to your students as they look at the South? Because clearly many of them come from other places, and, mm-hmm. and what are the pictures they carry in their heads, and how important is it to give them a clear view of this place?
Well, I'm teaching a class right now, a documentary photography class called Documentary Photography in the Southern Cultural Landscape, where I ask students to go out and picture the South in some way. And they define their own projects. And you're right, many of them at Duke are not from the South. Some are. A lot of what I challenge them to do is to think, to read about the South, to understand the way it's been depicted, the way it's characterized, the way it's represented, and to challenge those representations on their own terms, to think more critically about what the South is, so that they can get beyond thinking that to remake a Walker Evans photograph or to remake a Gordon Parks Farm Security Administration photograph is somehow connecting with the contemporary South. What is the South now, and how can we revise that image over and over and over again so that we're not in some mythic place of thinking we understand this this South that's fixed. And even though a photograph fixes an image, we need to refix it over and over and over again.
Well, we thank both of you so much for helping us fix those pictures in our heads. Riché Richardson is a professor of English at the University of California at Davis. Thanks, Riché.
Thank you.
And Tom Rankin is director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much.
Both are speaking at a conference today at UNC Chapel Hill on Navigating the Globalization of the American South. And coming up, hip-hop and Prophets of the Hood. That's with a PH, Prophets. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Gail Harris.
The future of hip-hop.
This joint right here. It's going out to all y'all groupies. Male groupies. Female groupies. Shit, a groupie is a groupie.
The hip-hop stylings of North Carolina's own little brother are easy enough to get into and may account for the group's popularity. But according to writer Imani Perry, more than a good groove is at work here. Little Brother, like much of hip-hop music, Perry says, occupies the unique public space where the sacred meets the profane within African-American culture. Imani Perry is an assistant professor at the Rutgers University School of Law in Camden, New Jersey. Her new book is called Prophets of the Hood, and she joins us now. Imani, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I guess the first question is, how is it that a law professor is writing a book on hip-hop, or maybe it's the other way around? How did a hip-hop fan and scholar come to become a law school professor?
Well, it actually both came out of my interest in American culture and politics. And I have a law degree, but I also have a PhD in American studies. And so my interest in hip-hop really emerged organically from studying various aspects of American culture that are embodied in hip-hop, and also the fact that a lot of important litigation in the early 90s came about as a consequence of the impact of hip-hop and as an introduction of a new form of art.
Did you grow up listening to it?
Absolutely. I can remember distinctly the first time I heard the Sugar Hill Gang when I was 5 years old. And in my adolescence, I stayed up all night frequently to listen to hip-hop on college radio stations, because back then you couldn't hear it on the mainstream channels. And so I think of it as the music that's really the soundtrack to my coming of age.
Is hip-hop a uniquely American phenomenon? Is there a difference between the hip-hop of the South versus New York versus the West Coast versions?
Well, one, it is a distinctly American form, although it has achieved global popularity, which I think really speaks to the way that it speaks to so many people. There are certainly regional variations in the music, and you can hear the dialect of various regions emerge with artists from different places, and everyone brings, you know, their own style to the form. So yeah, there are significant differences, and there's always this sort of wonderful process where a region or at times another country adds something to the stew of hip hop that is important and exciting and innovative.
And that's part of it, I suppose, that makes it uniquely American. Can you give us an example?
Well, one of the things that I found very interesting recently is the introduction of both classical music into hip hop and in particular an interest in the strings, and so violin and guitar, and also the introduction of East and South Asian music. So if you take for example an artist like Punjabi MC, who has really begun to achieve widespread success in the United States and has added elements of South Asian music very effectively and beautifully to, you know, to a hip-hop beat.
Yes. Live from the United States, Brooklyn, New York, it's your boy, Yo. The nephews is in the house. As soon as the beat dropped, we got the streets locked overseas. A Punjabi MC in the rock. I came to see the mommies in the spot. On the count of three, drop your body like it's hot. One, young.
What do you think mainstream America still just doesn't get about hip hop?
Oh, well, a couple of things. I mean, one of the primary objectives of the book was to really talk about what's happening aesthetically in the music and to connect it to older traditions in African American, both music and sort of folk poetry on the one hand. And so I think really, I mean, what I hope is part of the gift of it is to allow a larger audience to understand the music's complexity. On the other hand, I think one of the things that people don't get is that it's not simply a music full of sexism or misogyny or what have you, or violence and conspicuous consumption, but there's a lot of sort of nuanced and complicated politics that are involved in all of these sort of hot button issues that have come out of the music. And so I hope that my work enables people to have some more sophisticated or more nuanced understandings of all those things.
We have a 1988 song from Eric B. and Rakim, I Ain't No Joke. Let's listen to some of that, and then let's talk about it.
I got a question, as serious as cancer. Who can keep the average dancer hyper as a heart attack? Nobody's smiling, because you're expressing the rhyme that I'm styling. This is what we all sit down and write. You can't make it, so you take it home, break it, and bite. Use pieces and bits of all my hip-hop hits. Get the style down, packed, then it's time to switch. Put my tape on pause and add some more to yours. Then you figured you're ready for the neighborhood chores. The E-M-C-E-E, don't even try to be. When you come up to speak, don't even lie to me. You like to exaggerate, dream and imagine it. Then change the rhyme around, that could aggravate me. So when you see me come up, freeze, or you'll be one of those seven MCs. They think that I'm a new jack, but only if they knew that. They who think wrong, or they who can't do that style that I'm doing, they might ruin patterns of paragraphs based on you. And you all be DJ if anything he play sound familiar. I'll wait till E say play him. So I'ma have the diss. Who broke, you can get a smack for this. I ain't no joke.
What is this song illustrative of?
It illustrates several important elements in the music. One, you see the influence of black oral culture. So you see the braggadocio, you see the kind of tricksterism aesthetic where the cleverness, verbal dexterity are used as ways of overcoming adversity. You also see in the composition, Rakim is the rapper there and Eric B. is the DJ. And you see in the composition of the actual musical aspect, right, this sort of heterogeneity of different kinds of sounds that are brought together to create one aesthetic whole. And in older forms, this has been called by ethnomusicologists the heterogeneous sound ideal. In older forms, this was done in blues and jazz with a variety of instruments. In hip-hop, it's done with a variety of different sorts of recordings. So technology is inserted into this process of creating music.
Why do you think so many people find hip-hop uncomfortable music to listen to?
Well, I actually think a lot of the discomfort there's two things primarily. I mean, one has to do with one of the side effects of its authenticity. I think, and I mean that both with respect to a kind of emotional authenticity, but also with talking about a number of social ills, you know, poverty, frustration, various sorts of adversity, racism. It has this real kind of rawness in its authenticity, right? There's really a lack of kind of a sentimental discussion of these issues, and it's pretty driving and forthright. So I think that's a primary area of discomfort, and as part of that, you see evidence of, you know, the sort of vulgarity, this explicitness in the music. And it really does centralize people who are in many ways marginalized, the experiences of people living in housing projects in urban areas. And I think that's an uncomfortable reality for lots of people to witness.
Yeah, it's not la-la music. It is in your face.
No.
It is, hey, listen up, pay attention to this, hear
yes.
it. You know, there's a real
mm-hmm.
strength to it.
And it's aggressive. In its assertion of what it is saying and the kind of an insertion of the artist into the space, right, and then into cultural space.
Let's talk for a minute about some of the stereotypes of hip-hop. It's angry,
yes.
It's hopeless, it's obsessed with sex and violence, it's anti-female.
Right.
Let's hold the anti-female thought for a second, but what about
okay.
some of the other ideas? Why do you think those prevail?
I don't understand, actually, the image of it as hopeless, because it actually is an extraordinarily hopeful music. I mean, there's always these stories, and that's part of how it's deeply American, right? There's always these stories of individual transcendence, of a variety of difficult circumstances. And in terms of saying, you know, it's violent and it's obsessed with sex, well, no more so than our culture in general is. And I think that hip-hop receives greater censure than other, you know, than our film industry or television, largely because it's produced primarily by African Americans, and winds up being subject to more criticism as a result, and then also because it's really raw in its, you know, excesses. You know, the things that bother me that I see in hip hop also are the things that bother me when I watch The Swan or Want to Marry a Millionaire or Girls Gone Wild or, you know, all those sorts of things.
There's plenty out there to look at critically, isn't
yeah.
there?
Yes.
Well, then what about the women of hip-hop? I mean, what are the messages that you get from performers like Queen Latifah or Salt-N-Pepa?
Well, really, in their heyday in the early 90s, there was this wonderful flowering of a feminist discourse in hip-hop, and that was one of the first areas in which I started writing. And they were really talking about both, you know, a kind of feminist empowerment, but also figuring out ways to articulate sexual desire and to be, and, you know, kind of body confidence. And it's really a wonderful moment. And I actually think that as hip-hop became increasingly popular, the feminist presence diminished for a whole host of reasons. And so, you know, my hope, I sort of am holding out hope that you'll see the kind of rebirth of that wonderful kind of set of feminist voices, Queen Latifah, Salt-N-Pepa, Yo-Yo, MC Light. And they're all still around in various capacities, but not producing as much music.
You must be blind if you don't believe or hear. Listen to this rhyme. Ladies first, there's no time to rehearse. I'm divine and my mind expands throughout the universe. A female rapper with a message to send. The Queen Latifah is a perfect specimen.
My sister, can I get some?
Sure, Moni Love, grab the mic and get dumb.
Yo, praise me not for being simply what I am. Born in L-O-N-D-O and sound American. You dig exactly where I'm coming from. You want righteous rhyme and I'ma give you some. To enable you to age yourself and get paid. And the material that has no meaning I wish to slay. Pay me every bit of your attention. Like mother, like daughter, I would also like to mention. I wish for you to bring me through the rhythm. Of which is now systematically given. Desperately stressing I'm the daughter of a sister. Who's the mother of a brother. Who's the brother of another. Plus one more. All four. Have a job to do, we do, and a respect due to the mother who's the root of it. And next up is me, the M-O-N-I-E-L-O-V-E, and I'm first, cause I'm a L-A-D-I-E. Contact and in fact,
the style gets hard. Do you think hip-hop has changed dramatically since the time that Queen Latifah did that song?
Oh, absolutely. And there have been dramatic changes simply because the music has become so overwhelmingly popular. There's also have been dramatic changes because of the shift in video culture, which I think really has fueled more of the sexism in hip-hop than virtually anything else. And the objectification of women's bodies in video culture has really become this sort of cottage industry. I mean, there are whole shows dedicated to, you know, the videos, which include scantily clad women. And in a way, I think the pressure on women hip-hop artists to present themselves in very overtly sexy fashion has actually caused listeners to listen with to pay less attention to the feminist content of their music when it is present.
You also mentioned in the book that when you first began writing it, your friends were saying, hey, you'd better hurry up and finish this because hip-hop is on its way out. Well, that was in the late 90s. Clearly, it's still very much with us. Where do you think hip-hop is headed?
I just want to say in response to those friends very briefly, I was at Nassau Community College earlier today, and I saw a group of students there in New York who were beatboxing and break dancing and rhyming and doing spoken word. And I can tell you, hip-hop is alive and well. I mean, they're just extraordinarily beautiful performers. I talked to a young man who is involved in hip-hop production and also a classical violinist. I think that's a direction that it's going to continue to grow. I think in terms of using classical music, which is really interesting because it's in the public domain, and so much of it is, and so it can be sampled freely. The influences of various music traditions, I think, are going to grow. So you're going to see more South Asian music. You're going to see more East Asian music. There's an incredible hip-hop scene in Japan. And I think there's going to be really a revitalization of local music scenes and local hip-hop music scenes, not simply with respect to folks sort of trying to make it to the big time, but also just, you know, the local set where people exchange ideas and rhymes and poetry. And they're all over the country, but I really think, you know, that's where you can do the most kind of cutting-edge, innovative stuff, and it really blossoms in community.
Imani Perry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Imani Perry is an assistant professor of law at the Rutgers University School of Law in Camden, New Jersey. Her book is called Prophets of the Hood, Politics and Poetics in Hip Hop. And that is the state of things for today. We thank you for listening. If you have a comment about our program, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Gail Harris.
Look, if you had one shot, one opportunity, seize everything you ever wanted in one moment. Did you capture it? Just let it slip. Yo. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. Mom's spaghetti, he's nervous. But on the surface, he looks calm and ready to drop bombs. But he keeps on forgetting what he wrote down. The whole crowd goes so loud. He opens his mouth, but the words won't come out. He's choking how? Everybody's choking.